Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, Francisco. It's good to see you.
Likewise. What's on your mind today?
Well, you know, as we kind of move our way through the pandemic, and I hesitate to say that, are we moving through? I guess, you know, we're finding ourselves in a different place in the pandemic. And one of the conversation that comes up often is how this experience has changed people's lives in good ways, in bad ways. You know, all of us have been impacted, some in greater ways than others. But one profession, one area of our society has really taken a huge hit just because of the way the pandemic showed up, which meant we had to socially distance and we couldn't gather in groups. And those are artists and musicians. And those who, you know, make their living on performing and getting crowds out to come and hear their music or see their performances. And so I've been thinking a lot about, you know, the summer coming upon us and, you know, that I've always looked forward to, and I'm sure you have too, going to the music festivals and our own Live Oak Music Festival and, you know, getting to see some of my favorite artists. And last summer, you know, was, oh, that was awful, but it was really scary and we had to hunker down. But now we're, you know, rolling into summer number two and still not going to be able to get back to the level of music that we all kind of hope for, look forward to, and are going to live performances of any kind. But there are glimmers of hope. There's glimmers and light in the horizon that things are changing and that we're starting to gather and hear music or be able to see performances in different ways. And so I was thinking about how artists in different ways have benefited from having this time to kind of stop down or recalibrate or reinvent themselves out of necessity, but in some ways, maybe an opportunity to reset and see their life's work in a different way. Because I would imagine that as a touring artist, your life is really built around the tour. And so you have to sneak in new music or original projects in between tours, and having this kind of forced slowdown has caused people to pivot and find new ways to interact. So my guest today is an artist, musician, producer. He's also a member of Michael Franti and Spearhead, who have played often on the Central Coast and up and down throughout California and around the world. And he has taken this year to really pivot and reinvent himself. So I have gotten to know him over the last couple of years, and his story about his life as a musician is fascinating into itself, but how he has taken this year and kind of changed his brand, changed his direction, is wonderful. And because I love to share the stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary things, my guest today, Mike Blankenship, is a perfect example of that. So we're not going to waste a lot of time setting this up. We're just going to jump right into it. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. Although we're not taking phone calls, you can still be a part of our conversation by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can follow us on Facebook or check us out on Instagram. We have pictures up of Mike and some, we'll have this interview posted later so you can check it out. You can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org, and all 10 years of our programs are there. Or if you'd like to have the instant gratification, find us on podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. Search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe. Leave us a review. Helps other people find out about the show. And then our programs will be uploaded for you to listen to at your convenience. So we're going to take a quick break and listen to some of the music by our guest, Mike Blankenship. And then we'll be back to start our conversation and find out where the musical world has taken him. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
This is a new day. It is a day of Black people taking care of business. We are together and on one accord. But we got power. Today on this program, you will hear gospel, rhythm and blues, jazz. experience determines the sound of our soul.
Yeah, yeah, you know what this is. You know what I'm talking about. Come on and get right, right, right. And put your hands high, high, high. Cause we gon' make it lie, lie, lie. We gon' keep it lie, lie, lie. Yeah, we gon' make it fly, fly, fly. You can't take nothing from me. I stay on time like Blakey on the drum beat. All the way to primo, what the hell do I know? Started from scratch like the record touched the needle. Ain't taking you back like a modern day hero. Cold like Nat King Cole below zero. Everything I touch good as gold, never cheap though.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And you're listening to the music of Mike Blankenship. He is an artist, musician, producer. He's a touring member of Michael Franti and Spearhead. And he spent this last year kind of reinventing himself, his music, and his life in many ways. So, Mike, thanks for finding time to hang out with me for an hour.
Oh, of course. Thank you for having me.
All right. So what were we just listening to?
That was a song entitled Black Music. That was from my debut album, which actually came out a few years ago. And it was my first single release ever and the first track on the album. And it kind of sets the stage of what my music tends to be all about, which is, you know, I'm trained in primarily Black styles of music like jazz, R&B, soul, gospel, hip hop. And part of that study is just giving, you know, learning from the greats that came previously before my time. And I'm pretty big in almost anything I write or produce and paying homage to previous works. So that song was an homage to a lot of different things, like just like Black artistry, especially within music, from, you know, the earliest days of field songs to, you know, the breakthrough through the different jazz eras, from the early 1900s to, you know, R&B soul and all the different genres already listed. That's pretty much the premise of it.
And so let's kind of rewind and tell the history of Mike Blankenship and how you found your way to the piano and to making music. You grew up in the East Bay Area, correct?
Yeah. I grew up deep East Bay, Contra Costa, very like suburban atmosphere, neighborhoods. So most of my cultural experiences were really what my parents, you know, exposed me to in the house, which was, my dad was a DJ in college. He went to USF and my mom did as well, but he just had a vast record collection. And so, you know, as a young kid, I just grew up listening to all these classic records. And I think, you know, I believe there are people that have innate abilities to like translate into their own talents. And so I kind of like whatever I heard, I tried to play back. And my parents recognized that. And then they both invested in make sure I took piano lessons and I had the equipment I needed. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, it wasn't like a hard journey, but it was definitely a big part of, you know, connecting me to who I wanted to be, who I eventually became as an adult. So, yeah, those are those humble suburban beginnings.
But when you started off, what was, you know, did your parents have mandated, you know, you must play an instrument, pick up piano, and then they exposed you to all this music? Or were you hearing all these different genres, different music, and said, I want to do that? What, you know, who led first?
No, I mean, I think the honest to God story is that it was a tug of war between my parents about, like, you know, getting a piano and like, get, you know, I think they were both coming from a generation of their parents. My grandparents told them, like, hey, go to school, get an education. You know, this is the route, get a good job, you know, pension, retire. That's the cycle. And so they were in the midst of figuring that out for themselves. So like even the idea of bringing art, I think, was a little bit of a tug of war. But then I think they both saw it and they saw how I gravitated to it and would prefer playing the piano over playing with my toys. So they never really like, hey, you need to go in there and practice, you know, for an hour, you know. In fact, I wasn't even a great student. I wouldn't oftentimes learn like the pieces that were presented, and you know, like for a recital or something. I would play it to a point and then be like, let me play what I want to play. So they just kind of gave me the space. They're like, hey, he's out of our hair, and it's not like it sounds bad. So, you know, that was pretty much the rule of the house.
But now, where are you in your family? Do you have siblings?
I had a brother who unfortunately passed away 4 or 5 years ago. But growing up, I was pretty much the only kid, only child till I was about 14.
Okay. And so your parents either had a whole bunch of energy focused on you, or they were busy with their own stuff and were happy that you had a direction, it sounds like, or that you had an interest or a passion.
Yeah. I mean, they both were in corporate America. Like, you know, they both were college educated, and also just kind of thinking of those times, like they were the first in their families to even have the opportunity to go to college and make something for themselves financially, and like building like what was considered the, you know, American home. They also grew up in the era of like everybody's getting divorced, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yep. Were you a latchkey kid at some point?
The whole time. I mean, my school had like daycare, so, you know, I could stay at the school up to a point, but I would get picked up like at 6 p.m. and like barely have any time to like, you know, eat and like take a bath and do homework. It was just like, I went to a school that was like 30 minutes away from the house. So it wasn't even like my school was centered in any kind of community that I had access to all the time.
So you were fairly isolated, which in some ways gave you more time to focus on music, but in other ways could have kept you from feeling like probably you had a friend group or get involved in school activities.
Yeah, I mean, I did like sports and stuff. I got into that. And there was a point where I gave up on like taking piano lessons, probably when I was like 11. I'm like, hey, I'm getting older. I'm trying to recognize I'm a little bit into girls at this point, and like I want to, you know, do things that are a little bit cooler than like piano recitals. So yeah, so I you know, I don't have any, like, I didn't feel isolated. I just, you know, I didn't know any better. Mm-hmm. I didn't know any better. I was the only kid, so I just figured this is what life is.
Yeah, isn't it amazing, right? Whatever we live becomes our normal until someone tells us that it's not.
right.
So at what point, Mike, did you then make that switch to dedicated, I am an artist, musician, and I'm all in? Like, did you graduate from high school and then go in? Did you go to college? Like, where was that transition where you said, everything else aside, this is who I am?
It's like as quickly as I could say it, it's like a three-part journey. There was, you know, I was clearly into music, and I was like into the piano, but didn't have much application of what that meant with a band. I just knew piano and like playing along with like albums. So around the time my parents got divorced when I was 9 or 10, my dad had moved out and he got his own place. And when I would be with him, like I would switch back and forth every week with my parents, and when I would be with my dad on the weekends, we would go to San Francisco and just kind of hang out and do stuff together, or go to Monterey. And it was really treasured time for me, because obviously that was traumatic, them getting divorced. But he would always play this Miles Davis tape, which is pretty much the most famous jazz album of all time, Kind of Blue. And it became like the soundtrack of the separation. Mm-hmm. You know? And just kind of like this newfound like moment of my adolescence. And so then fast forward to that, to like when I was in high school, I was really developing my ear, and I had a keyboard and I was making all these beats. And one day I just had an opportunity to share them with kids in the school. And like, before I knew it, I had half the class in the music room listening to my beats. So it was kind of like an aha moment, like, oh, okay, like I can, like people like it. I didn't know that people were really into the music I was creating. And then the last stage was, I was in junior college, and I took a jazz appreciation class only really as a general ed requirement. I wasn't really like, I hadn't figured out my in on the music side, but I was like, let me just take this class. And halfway through the semester, they're in the different eras of jazz, and then the bebop era, and then the instructor played the Kind of Blue album from top to bottom. And it was just like this crazy nostalgic attachment. And I was quoting all of like Miles Davis and John Coltrane lines in my mind. And I was like, I haven't heard this music in like 10 years. And so after that class, I didn't go back to school that day. And I went to Tower Records and I bought the Miles Davis album, went home and just like studied it intensely. And was like, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a jazz pianist and I'm going to be the best jazz pianist I can possibly be. And that was really like those three stages really were the catalyst to kind of project me where I'm at now.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to my guest, Mike Blankenship. He's an artist, musician, producer. He is a touring member of Michael Franti and Spearhead's band. And he's my guest today to talk about kind of his journey in the music world and what has changed or pivoted for him since he hasn't been on the road for the last year, and who knows when they'll be back. How has his life changed? This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And so Mike, you go all in junior high. I'm guessing you're like 19 years old. What is the career path? How are you supporting yourself? You know, do you move out of home? Do your parents say you're on your own? How did you find your footing?
I definitely owe my parents a load of credit for all the support that they gave me. And when I got out of high school, I was just like not ready to live on my own. I was not one of those like, yo, I'm gonna get my own place. And everything was late for me. I got my license late, you know, like got my first girlfriend late. You know, I was just like, everything was just late blooming. And so I was able to stay specifically with my dad till I was about 22, because I had to go to junior college and actually learn how to like play. It's unlike a lot of other like majors. It's not just like, hey, I have an interest in this, let me apply to be you know, whatever. With the arts, it's like, no, you got to prove that you can actually do this. Mm-hmm. So I had to build up my chops. I had to go to school and I had to take these classes semester after semester until I knew I was confident enough to go into an audition and place and, you know, continue on with the program. So that was the transition was definitely. And then in between that time, I also had opportunities to like, I was getting good and I was getting gigs locally and I was playing in a church. And so I was really expanding my education beyond just like when I was taking jazz classes at junior college.
But were you thinking, hey, I'm going to be a touring jazz musician, or I'm going to be a solo artist, or what was the dream, you know, in when you first started mastering the jazz genre?
I think it was just being part of like a group or an artist or a movement. Like it was very rooted in like, hey, I'm just one cog in the wheel of a band, but I see my role and I see how I can help others in the band, you know, create better and maybe in a sense. And then like, I can also create because I have them as my support. And they, you know, so I wasn't looking at like, this is the Mike Blankenship show and here are my songs and only pay attention to me. That kind of came a little bit later, but still in its own like curated way where I still like supporting other artists within my own art.
But you liked being part of a community, it sounds like. You liked having a place you belonged and people who respect. So when did you start kind of doing your own music? When did you start creating your own sound?
After my son was born in 2009, I had just turned 30 and I was having, you know, my son was about to be born, and it was like an instant maturity moment. It was just kind of like any doubts I had in my 20s, which I had, I'm like, you know, like all of us, we have insecurities, but in art, you know, it's so subjective that like you could feel good about something one day and feel like it's trash the next day, and somebody can have an opinion about it, you know, another day. And you can feel better about it, but then you get some critique from someone you don't know. I mean, it's kind of like how social media works, but just like real life.
Yeah.
So it took, you know, time to get over that hump and really find my voice, and just the maturity that comes with like the responsibility of being a parent and like knowing that the decisions you make moving forward reflect more than just yourself. My main goal was to like put together a project that, you know, being in the touring industry is volatile. We hear about artists passing all the time for various reasons. Not that I do nothing crazy, but I'm part of that world. It's not a 9-to-5 where I go to the same place every day. So I was just like, I want my son to be able to grow up. And if something does happen to me, he has an account of who his dad was from his, you know, my thoughts, even my own voice, you know, my artistic creations, and he doesn't have to rely on somebody else's account. And so when I did my album, I dedicated it to him. And, you know, that was really the birth of my artistry. It was just kind of growing up, you know?
So prior to him being born, you were 30, were you touring with any bands then, or were you doing still local gigs up until that point?
Yeah, I know I did a lot of touring. Right before he was born, I was touring with an artist named Lyrics Born. But prior to that, I was touring with Lauryn Hill. And that was like obviously a pretty big deal. And I learned a lot about myself as a man. I think that was a very defining moment. And as a man, I just mean like as like my own confidence in like decision-making and what I, the standards that I'll create for myself professionally. I learned a lot in that experience. And prior to that, I worked with a very talented artist, Lettucey, who's from the Bay Area in New Orleans. And she just won a Grammy, her first Grammy this year. So I'm very proud of her. But yeah, I had all these great experiences, like just kind of flood my career in my 20s. And so, of course, I was taking it all in and traveling the world. And like, and it was just like so surreal.
Mm-hmm. You know, what were... I mean, because you said it taught me how to be a man or to make choices. So it sounds like being on tour with Lauryn Hill or maybe with all the artists, that you go one of two ways, right? You either live the crazy tour lifestyle that people hear about musicians do, or you have to kind of carve out some routine. I mean, because I'd imagine your early 20s, you would want to be in the party all the time. So how did you have that consciousness? Like, I don't know if I need to go all in.
I really think it's just, I think some of that is a misconception. I mean, okay. It comes down to the people. Sometimes it comes down to the genre. I mean, when we were playing with Lauryn Hill, like she ruled with a very like authoritative like presence. And so a lot of times we would do our shows and then we'd have like follow-up meetings immediately afterwards where we're like critiquing the performance for an hour. And so any like, you know, at that time, if any groupies or any like fun we was trying to have, it was gone. And plus Lauryn Hill was a very like empowering artist. And especially, you know, in ways that needed to, in ways where, you know, certain voices had been muted for so long, and primarily from the Black female experience. And so like the whole band of guys who were in their 20s, like looking out in the crowd, is like those women weren't having it. They weren't looking at us. Yeah. Problems.
Exactly. You were the poster children for why everyone was struggling.
Yeah, but you know, I was really into like being a great, you know, as good of a musician I can. Of course, we meet people in our travels and have fun and all that. But mostly everyone I've toured with is pretty responsible. They're not like, it's not like we're in Motley Crue or nothing, you know, it's never really that crazy.
Well, and it sounds like you really love music for music's sake, that you didn't, you know, a lot of people you talk about, they join bands or get into music because they wanted to pick up chicks, right? They wanted to be in a band that girls adored. It sounds like you do music because of music.
Yeah.
So no, when you're,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, when your son's born at 30, what shifts? I mean, do you leave touring or and you're just at home, or how did you shift things up and you know, where did that take you? Because at some point you start touring with Michael's band.
Yeah, when my son was born, I did take some time off, not necessarily because I wanted to, but it was just costly, like. you just kind of thrown into this world of childcare and in California, which is mad expensive. But again, it kind of like you were saying earlier, it played a similar role, like how this pandemic has from my artist standpoint, where I was at home and I learned the true value of time. Like before my son was born, I could play video games all day and be like, okay, what time I gotta be at rehearsal? What time I gotta be at the gig? And like just trick off a whole day and not be that productive. But when I had my son and his mom would go to work and be gone for 8 hours, and I'm like, you know, over here like feeding, cradling, and of course loving my son, but don't have time to do anything but like make sure he stays alive. Mm-hmm. 1 hour he would go to sleep, I'd be so productive. I would get so much done in that hour, where like before he was born it was like I waste the whole day. So I started to understand the importance and the value and even just the slightest amount of free time. And that's how I started working on my album. I wasn't able to tour, but I was able to work on my own art with my son, like kind of like rocking next to me, like, you okay? I'm about to put these headphones on. I'm not going to hear you cry for a while.
You're just going to be background at this point. And so that first album came out in what year?
In 2015.
So that was a good stretch of time. That was like 6 years then, right? That you put into making this.
Yeah.
And how is it received? How were you able to roll it out?
You know, I'm an independent artist, so it was a great rollout from my perspective, you know, comparatively to like, you know, like Michael Franti, like he's I think he's independent or he's got label support or something, but he's got a name, right? You know, mm-hmm. This up over decades, but this is my first crack at it. So I felt like it was really well received, you know, especially within the community that I live in. I had been labeled in my own mind, and I just feel like in the community as a side man, you know, mm-hmm. just part of the band. I'm playing for this artist, playing for that. I'm playing for all the artists. I'm playing for all the events. And I kind of noticed that another reason why I was inspired to make the album is because I was working with all these artists and they weren't asking me to produce anything. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was like, man, like they love the way I play, but they don't like ask me to write with them. And I don't think it was ever anything personal. They just had labeled me too.
Right.
So part of the album was like, I'm going to show people that I have, you know, incredible ear for production. I believe that. And you know, I'm not faulting anybody else for not believing in it or not knowing it, but I'm going to just hit everybody, you know, out of nowhere. And that's what happened. And I think that's where most of the positive responses came from. It was like, wow, we didn't even know you could do this. And it's amazing. And one thing I also worked on was like promoting it. Like social media was really kind of kicking off in a way where artists were using it as a way to get the word out about their projects. And so I had like a whole year plan of like content that I was putting out before content was really like the hot buzzword. So I felt really good about it. I felt like I got the most I could do with my own money and my own energy.
Being your own cheerleader. And you said earlier that you're kind of a late bloomer. So it doesn't surprise me that all the people you worked with wouldn't notice how brilliant you were, because you're always a little under the radar, not, you know, tooting your own horn or kind of coming into your own maybe a little later than everyone else. And so let's this other song that you shared with me, Devil's Pie, is that also from the first album?
No, that's actually a recent release. Just came out in, I want to say last month. It was March, right? Yeah, like almost a month ago.
This is part of your pandemic work.
Yeah. It started a little bit before that. Myself, another great artist who was actually the guy rapping on the first song, Black Music, his name is Kev Choice, and then Howard Wiley, who's the saxophonist, we formed a group. We're all here local in the Bay Area, but we've all traveled the world doing, you know, stuff individually and for other artists. And we were all on that Lauryn Hill tour. That's one thing that kind of links us all together. But we formed this group, Black London, And we our first and last concert, like big main concert, was literally like a month or two before this whole thing got shut down. And we did a dedication to D'Angelo, his album Voodoo, which had came out 20 years prior, 2000. And we did a whole like dedication to that album and kind of reimagined a lot of the songs. And so Devil's Pie is actually a cover from that album. It was actually D'Angelo's first release off that album. And that album was just really significant to all of us because at that point we were in our, you know, like we were in our 20s, early 20s. And it really developed a sound that we still kind of gravitate towards today.
If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Mike Blankenship. He's a musician, artist, producer, touring musician. And we're talking about music and art and what artists have done to pivot during the pandemic. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And let's listen to a bit, Francisco, of Devil's Pie before we go into a break. And then we'll come back and we'll talk about the sound that you've been developing throughout your adult life. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. This is Devil's Pie by Black London.
The slice, want the pie, why is why, until we fry, watch us all, stand in line for a slice of Devil's Pie. Drugs and thugs, women, wine, three or four at a time. Watch them all, stand in line for a slice of Devil's Pie.
Who am I to justify all the evil in our eyes? When I myself feel the high from all that I despise.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And that was a bit of Devil's Pie, music by Black London. I guess a cover, Mike, you said, is it an homage in some ways to D'Angelo?
Yeah, it's a cover, but it's reharmonized. The original was produced by a really prominent hip hop producer, DJ Premier, who like produced for everybody, based like Jay-Z and Notorious B.I.G. But he produced this song for D'Angelo, who traditionally was kind of like an R&B soul crooner. And we just did a take of it that was a little bit more on the jazzier side, I guess. But like still wanted to pay tribute to not only like just the stylings of D'Angelo, but the message of the song is just so, you know, unfortunately, I don't know, I guess it's a reflection of American greed and capitalism and how we're all just like willing to sell it all out just to get a piece of, you know, the pie that, you know, we're willing to maybe stomp on our neighbor to get to, you know, and it's just an unfortunate truth that is difficult to speak on. But I think it's really prominent, you know, really a reflection of the times right now, too.
Yeah, it resonates. It unfortunately, it stays relevant with each passing decade. Right. Francisco's eyes lit up as you started talking about D'Angelo, and I know he's dying to ask you something.
Hey, Mike. Yeah. So with, you know, D'Angelo, in terms of his musicianship, has been revered among, you know, the, you know, R&B for just how talented he is. And I just want to hear more about how, you know, for you, you know, as a musician, what D'Angelo's approach to music has been, especially considering his limited output over his entire career, three albums over the course of the span of three decades, effectively. So what does that approach to musicianship mean to you? And how does, you know, how do you apply it to your own craft?
Great question.
Yeah. Great question. I think, you know, at that time, like 2000, I was like 21, 22 years old. And I was heavily into jazz, but it was almost like a very stark contrast. It was like it was either jazz, which was swinging, or it was like all the way R&B, which typically was like, it was great musicians that were producing these songs, but they weren't like bands anymore. Like that that era had kind of got killed off in the 80s, you know. But, you know, in the 70s, you had great funk bands like, you know, Kool and the Gang, Sly and the Family Stone, the Commodores, and, you know, so many to choose from. But my era, like the generation that I was a part of, they weren't doing that. So D'Angelo had put out Brown Sugar, and, you know, it was still kind of a reflection of what I'm talking about. But when he put out Voodoo, it was literally like a band got in the studio and they recorded however many tracks, 14, 15 songs. And every song kind of, you could tell it's the same instrumentation. So it was the first time I could hear all these jazzy, bluesy, R&B, soul elements in like an actual band. And I think that's how a lot of musicians of my time were gravitating towards it. And there was just, it was an all-star cast of musicians like Roy Hargrove and Amir Thompson from The Roots, and Charlie Hunter, and just so many to name. I can't think of them all right now, but it was like basically like the holy grail of how I started to evolve even some of the stuff I was going to work on in the future.
So it's almost like was your launching point, even though you studied jazz and kind of worked your way through, it sounds like that album or D'Angelo's work gave you a touchstone point where people say, I was influenced by the Beatles or I was influenced by the blues. That sounds like that was your moment where you go, oh yeah, that's my direction. Or yeah, that's
it's the, what's the Sergeant Peppers. It's that for me, you know, that album was that for me.
And so I really want to be able to spend the last half of the show talking about how you've pivoted since coming off the road, because we met while you're touring with Michael Franti and Spearhead. You know, full disclosure, my daughter Kelly worked with Michael, and so she got to hang out with you for a couple of years. And when, you know, that's a busy life. I mean, just watching her, from her perspective, being on the road nonstop for 2 years, when that all came to an end last March, first, what was your reaction? Because you have a son that you're supporting and sending to school, and you've got, you know, your life you're trying to support, and that dries up and it's done. What was your first reaction? And then how did you start to pivot?
I mean, the obvious first reactions were, you know, man, I'm going to miss playing music, and man, how am I going to keep these lights on? Yeah, that was scary, you know, and obviously the music art industry, especially touring industry, is affected the most, because the whole idea is built on the fact that all these people could cram into one space, thousands of people just like hovering on top of each other, screaming at the top of their lungs, like this is not very COVID friendly. So I kind of knew like, wow, what are we looking at 2022, 2023? And I think I just had to, shift gears, you know? I had to take advantage, of course, of the things that, resources that were there, like unemployment, which I had never done before, but very thankful for that. But also, I think I had a time, it was a time for things to kind of like, obviously pause, and I could take an assessment of like, well, what's the trajectory? Even if this didn't happen, like, would I just keep doing this? And I love to tour, don't get me wrong, but like, I don't want to look back and be like, well, where did I leave my imprint? You know, mm-hmm. I am part of this band, but you know, Michael being the lead artist is leaving an imprint that is more, you know, recognizable when you look at him, and it reflects in what's going on with, you know, his family and his loved ones. And, you know, I want to be able to have that same, even in my role as part of Spearhead, I want to be able to have those things going on in the background. So I'm not just like, well, when we're gigging, like I can only be excited if we have a tour. And I've never been like that anyways, but I just looked at it as an opportunity. So I started looking into grants, which I had never done before, and learned like all these different, all this funding that was out there that really kind of supported the things I wanted to talk about anyways in my music, like Black fatherhood and kind of debunking the myths of Black fathers not being present or involved, where studies show that Black fathers who are present tend to be more involved than a lot of other cultures. And I also giving back to the educational aspect of music arts that, you know, birthed my ability to do what I do today. So I kind of had a time to like just kind of chill and like assess everything and figure out new plans, that while things kind of work their way back to normal.
Well, it sounds like I can hear a little bit of a theme in the story that it's important to you to make a mark in some way, that you don't want your existence as a human being to have always been a backup guy or just a member of the band, that it's important to you that your voice and your talent or your values get expressed in some way that for no one else, maybe just your son can look back and say, here's who my dad was. Is that part of it?
Yeah, yes, a huge part of it. And I always say, like, I would never knock anybody for just wanting to play and you know, execute at a high level. But I feel like the beauty about art, and specifically with music, is that I just didn't want to be someone that, it's like any job, like, you know, when you work 40 years for a company, you retire, it's like all they do is just find someone else to do the same job.
True.
And I'm not knocking that life. I just wanted to feel like I'm contributing to the overall idea of music. Mm-hmm. You know, I can put out an album, I could put out music, I can do things that'll be stamped in time and be like, wow, if he didn't exist, like, we don't have this. And you know, it's nothing against being like, hey, I just play in bands, hey, I just support artists, but for me, that's not enough.
Right. There's something deeper driving you. And so I know there's a nonprofit built into the story. And did that start in the pandemic, or is this something you were working on prior to everything shutting down?
By prior, like a week.
Oh, really?
It was like a week before. And it started with a longtime collaborating friend of mine, Jerron Thompson, who I met at San Francisco State University, which is where I went after junior college. And we developed a very successful and popular gospel choir there called the Gospel Gators. Mm-hmm. And we would sell out these nightclubs. We were doing like all kinds of stuff that was kind of out the box, but we were selling out nightclubs for our semester ending concert, and we would sell like 700 tickets for every any semester concert. And we just grew into this huge production, and a lot of it was stemming from our passion, and a lot of it was stemming from my experiences from doing big productions. And like at the climax, we ended up doing a gospel choir competition at the Staples Center in front of like 20,000 people, and we got second place out of like only five choirs selected of the whole West Coast.
Wow.
Those were like professional touring choirs. We were like students who had like 2 weeks. You know, we just kind of gave it our all and had a great time. And but anyways, fast forward to this last year, me and Jerron got together and had this idea of like creating a almost like an after school kind of, you know, music education program, because, you know, there's so much emphasis on STEM curriculums. And I know there's talks and shifts to adding arts in the STEAM, you know, mm-hmm. curriculum, but, you know, in underserved communities, they just don't exist. You know, like in East Oakland out here, Richmond, all those departments are usually subsidized by some outside nonprofit, and which of those are great, but I feel there's such a need for it, because a lot of times studies show that these are positive vehicles to get people in better situations in their life. The arts have proven to do that. And so that was a big part of wanting to develop this. And then like we have just a beautiful team of like it's like six or seven of us, and it just kind of like once the wheels started turning, like we just started putting more and more time and resources into it. And it's like, it's grown to a point where I can't even like talk about the particulars for like legal purposes.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's been another positive thing, you know, to kind of, like you said, shift and like, you know, leave an imprint where it doesn't just affect me. It affects young people who are like creatives as well. And they're looking for these outlets to have like a possible better life.
What's the name of the nonprofit?
It's Yeah Art. And I'm not saying it as exclaimed as it probably should be, but it's like, yeah, comma, art, exclamation point.
Okay, yeah, art.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's it. And you can find out more about it. We have a website, yeahart.org. And you can also donate to it if you feel like you want to support some people who are really trying to do the best for communities that raised us and really just need the support more than a lot of areas.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And my guest today is Mike Blankenship. He is an artist, musician, producer, founder of Yeah Art, the nonprofit bringing arts to underserved communities. He also is a member of Black London. And how many albums have you released with Black London?
We have technically just released the one song.
Oh, is that Devil's Pie?
Yeah, it was our debut. We have another, we have an album, a full album that's coming out though. We did an actual tribute album for the whole Voodoo project. It's called Black Magic, and it'll be coming out in like the next few months. We're just kind of working out promotional plan stuff, but the music's all done, recorded, and ready to release. It's just like, we want people to hear it.
You need more pandemic time. So you have the one other song you shared with me is called I Can't Help It. Mm-hmm. Where is that from? Talk a little bit about that, and then let's listen to some of it.
Yeah. So that's also another cover, and I have original stuff too, but a song I did with a great friend of mine, a super talented friend named Cy Smith. And it is a cover of Michael Jackson's I Can't Help It from the Off the Wall album, which came out like before I was born, I think, maybe a year before. But yeah, I'm really big into reharmonizations. And this song is probably the best example of how far I can go off the deep end with like just different jazzy approaches to like recreating a song that was already, you know, written. And Stevie Wonder wrote the song for Michael. And so what I wanted to do was do something that was like very Stevie-esque, but like not exactly what Stevie did. And I also wanted to, you know, pay tribute to all these great hits that Michael Jackson created while I was growing up, because he was a huge musical influence for me, not as a dancer or a singer, but just like the energy. I just like, man, I just love all this stuff. So that's what it is.
This is I Can't Help It, revisioned by Mike Blankenship. And this is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX Francisco. Let's listen to a bit.
Surprise, I can't help but see you running often through my mind, helpless like a baby, sensual disguise. I can't help but love you, it's getting better all the time.
That is I Can't Help It, Mike Blankenship. And is that Mike Blankenship with Black London, or is that Mike Blankenship on his own? And you're not singing in there. So are you Are you the producer of the harmony sounds, or are you singing on these cuts?
I am not singing on anything that you've played thus far. I do sing on my album, on like a couple songs. I rap on a couple songs. But like I was kind of saying earlier, I'm really into like producing songs that I feel fit other people's, you know, voices and styles. And like I met Psy, so this song is my song featuring Psy Smith, but I met Psy touring with Sheila E. We both performed with Sheila E. for about 3 years together, and we were just like long lost kindred, like brothers and sisters in music. And we would be in sound checks, and she would just start singing something. I was like, oh my gosh, I remember that from like 1987. And then me and her would just be going off in our own little world, and everybody else in the band is looking at us like, what are they doing? So I have this really like strong musical bond with her, and she's just a wonderful person. It really helped me out a lot from a business standpoint, and obviously just gracing these songs with incredible vocals. But I'm big on like just collaborating. So my full album it features probably like 14 other artists.
Wow.
I don't claim to be a singer like that. I'm more kind of like a vibe, kind of like, you know, but like I know some singers, like I know some people that can blow. So why not just cut to the chase and get them to sing these songs?
But it sounds like that great ear that you have, that you mentioned, is in how to pull the right people and the right sounds together to create whatever that vision or that sound is that you're feeling at the time, or right, what's coming through. And I'm curious, in our last few minutes, you know, you've blown up this year in ways, you know, you have the nonprofit that's taken off. You've got your music, Black London, and things are being released. You also just recorded the music for a covered California ad. Like, that's a departure in itself as well, a whole other direction. And are we going to be hearing that?
It's a very welcome new direction. Yeah, it's actually out. My mom was the first one to tell me, like, I heard your commercial. I didn't, you know, like most people dream of like, you know, mom, I'm on the radio, but like not in a commercial.
But the commercial pays the bills, right?
I mean, no, there's licensing fees. There's all kinds of like cool extra little payouts that happen in that licensing world. But it was you know, it was just a very simple ad. All I did was play key drums on it. It's not musical, like compared to what you played, it you wouldn't even think like, oh, who put that together? It's just supporting the cause of Cover California, which is a very good one. It's at a very low rate. Yeah. Again, I'm a producer. I always make sure I throw that in there. Like artists, you know, I'm a musician, but like producing is a joy for me. I'm at the studio like 8 hours a day, just like working on stuff. So it doesn't have to be for me or Black London or an artist I'm working for.
So it looks like a few things are going to be opening up. Are you going to be getting back on the road, you hope? Are you going to head out with Michael and Spearhead again? What's looking forward for you?
Michael's definitely going out again actually pretty soon. I'm not at liberty to talk about the dates.
I wasn't gonna ask.
But it's definitely happening, not to the extent that, you know, fans are used to, because of the obvious. Mm-hmm. But eventually, you know, as things open up and the vaccination kind of becomes more of a normalized thing, I think, you know, next year you'll probably see some resemblance of like what it used to be.
And are you excited about that, or do you feel like you've kind of found a new groove? And I'd imagine your son's getting at the age, those teenage years, where you want to be on top of them a little bit more too, right?
Yeah, definitely. That's probably the thing I've enjoyed the most, is spending time with my son. Like I hadn't spent a summer with him in the last 6 years, because Michael goes on tour. We're gone like 4 or 5 months in a row. And so, and typically over the summer. So, like, I was like, oh man, I never taught you how to ride a bike. So that summer I taught him how to ride a bike, and like, you know, he's skateboarding now. And yeah, you're right. He's a super smart kid. And like, I'm playing catch up, even though we're very tight, we're super tight, but I'm playing catch up with how advanced his mind is, you know. And as he learns new words, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, let me Google that real quick to make sure I know what he's talking about. But I'm excited because I love traveling and I love touring. And one of the things I want my son to know is that, like, life is balance, and I'm not going to do everything right as a parent, but I definitely need to show him that I'm living life the way that I want to live it for myself. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't want him to be like, oh well, I got, you know, a family, I have kids, so that means I have to, you know, tighten up and get a job that provides this, that, and the other. Like, it doesn't have to be that way. I understand why people do that, and I have nothing against it, but I want to prove to him that he can live life, love life, and still be a great parent, still care about you know, your loved ones and friends, and
doing right by the world in some way, right? Yeah. You don't want him to give up his life for a piece of the devil's pie.
Right, exactly.
And I think that's what we should go out with today, Francisco. Let's pull up the devil's pie. It will be our ending song. Mike Blankenship, thank you so much for spending an hour with me. How can people hear, you know, keep in touch with you in Black London? Is Instagram, or where can they find your music?
Our music's on all the music outlets. So if you're on Spotify or Apple Music, it's there. Also, for the indie supporters, we have a Bandcamp. You can find it there. To keep in contact with us, Instagram, I think, is where we're excelling the most. So Black London Music, I think at Black London Music is our Instagram handle. And then my personal one is at Mike Blankenship with the underscore at the end. Don't name your kids Mike, because everything will be taken, every domain.
Yes, you won't be able to find your part. I can't wait to see you back on the road again, Mike. But until then, I'll be listening through Instagram, whatever you release. Thank you for tuning in for another week with a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can podcast our shows, listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. As always, thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back next Tuesday at 2.
Want the pie? Why is why? Until we fry. Watch us all stand in line for a slice of devil's pie. Drugs and thugs. We-